right, welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show. Really glad to be here today. A whole lot to talk about. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution and initiator of StopPatriarchy.org, and she's on the road with the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. We spoke with her last week, and we'll be talking every week. We'll be talking with her, updating us on what's going on and the critical questions that they're facing and encountering on the ride. So stay tuned for that. In the middle of the show, we'll be talking with Osha Gray Davidson. Now, Osha is a writer who focuses on energy, the environment, and other social and human rights issues. He's got an article in the most recent issue of Rolling Stone. It's called The Great Burning, How Wildfires Are Threatening the West, where he argues that terrifying blazes are the new normal in the West. It's going to be a really interesting conversation. The article is really a hell of an article. Opening the show up, on Tuesday, July 30th, Bradley Manning was convicted in a military show trial of espionage and theft charges for making available to the public classified documents. Everybody knows that now, and they know what the verdict is. He revealed evidence of U.S. war crimes and bullying of other countries. He could be sentenced to what amounts to life in prison during the sentencing phase of his trial. Meanwhile, those guilty of those war crimes and the crimes against humanity in the Bush and Obama regimes are free to continue their crimes. Well, joining us to talk about all this is Deborah Sweet, director of World Can't Wait. Deborah, how are you?
I'm glad to be here, Michael.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us today. Let's jump into it so we don't waste 1 minute. Your assessment of the verdict. You actually were at the trial for a little while. What's your assessment of the verdict? And then we'll talk a little bit more about your overall sense of the trial.
Yeah, I was at key parts of the trial, including the closing arguments and the verdict on Tuesday. My assessment is this is just outrageous. It's true that Bradley was not convicted of the most serious charge, aiding the enemy, which could have put him in prison for life or even had him executed. But he was found guilty of 19 charges of espionage and theft. Here comes the U.S. government with all its power and might charging this guy as being a spy, as if he were working for some other entity or government, getting paid, doing something consciously that this law was set up to stop, the Espionage Act of 1917. That law has a whole outrageous history of going after immigrants and communists in the past, but to use it in this case of someone who clearly was a whistleblower, someone who was in the U.S. military, sitting in his tiny computer room in a forward operating base outside of Baghdad in the fall of 2009, seeing coming across his computer screen evidence of atrocities on the part of the U.S., and mostly from his own declaration that he gave in February, telling us that he heard his fellow soldiers laughing about Iraqi civilians dying. And he felt, still does, and has stuck to his principles, that the people had to hear about this. And then maybe a conversation could start up where people would say, no, not in our name. We're going to stop our government from doing these things.
Now, tell me this, Deborah, and let me remind people, in case you're just tuning in, we're talking with Deborah Sweet, the director of World Can't Wait, and we're talking about the Bradley Manning verdict and the trial and what's going on now. Deborah, as you said, you were there for key aspects of the trial. A lot of people referred to it as a show trial, which I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff concentrated in what's been happening. And we'll talk about sort of the trifecta that's going on with Assange and Snowden and Manning. But right now, you know, people referred to Manning's trial as a show trial. What do you think of that assessment?
Well, you know, Glenn Greenwald said this, and I have to agree with it. First of all, it's a military trial. So there's not the same, you don't have the same protections when you're in the military as you would have even in a criminal civil trial in the U.S., and that's problematic enough. But the defense argued for years to be able to even get access to the information they needed. The government fought at every point to keep even a lot of the evidence away from the defense on the grounds of course, national security, that it's too risky for even the defense lawyers to be able to know what Bradley Manning is charged with leaking. So there was a lot of fight over this, and in the whole guilt phase of the trial, which just ended with the verdict, Bradley was really, and his defense attorneys were really not able to very much bring out why he did what he did. So you have the government making these assertions that And I think their primary assertion was this, that Bradley Manning was working for WikiLeaks and that he took their most wanted list from 2009, which they put out on the Internet, and he searched through government files, which he had access to because he was an intelligence analyst, directed to, as part of his job, look through all these files, and that he gave this information to WikiLeaks as part of a nefarious plot to have the enemies of the United States see this information on the Internet. The implications of that are vast. First of all, identifying Bradley and WikiLeaks, and especially Julian Assange, as spies and as people who were putting up this information expressly to harm the United States and its government. And secondly, the implications of it run to everything that the news media is supposed to do, and especially around national security. Many, many people are saying, if Bradley and WikiLeaks are found guilty of espionage for publishing this information, then what's to stop the government from finding any news media outlet who publishes material on the Internet to be guilty of espionage, or even in the future, aiding the enemy? That's part of the outrage of this. It's the clampdown on any possible political dissent. Even getting the truth out to the people now has become a crime.
There's an element of irony in this because the political ramifications for this are just, you know, as you're saying, they're outrageous. They're horrendous in terms of whistleblowers, in terms of the media, the limitations put on all this stuff. But there's also, you know, as we know, the media in this country is not sort of this, you know, as it often presents itself, a fourth estate. It's sort of independent of all this. You really have to fight to find media that's not somehow putting forward the view in one way or another of this or that faction of the rulers of this country. And in terms of this, there actually wasn't the kind of coverage you would think that something like the immensity in terms of the impact or the importance of the trial of Bradley Manning and what he's accused of doing and what he did, what he admits to doing, and the purpose of it and all the stuff that it revealed, you would think that the courtroom would have been overflowing with all of the mainstream major media. People would have been rushing to get into this, even if it was just on the basis of, geez, it's going to impact our ability to function. But no, nothing there.
Well, you would think. I mean, in fact, there were 99 members of the media at the sentence, at the verdict, but every other day almost, there were a handful of people, really dedicated people like Kevin Gastola and Alexa O'Brien and a couple of others, Clark Stokely, who was then banned from the whole base, who were covering this every day and really struggling to get out the truth. But yes, indeed, the major media of the ruling class dipped in to say, essentially, oh, this is good. He wasn't found guilty of aiding the enemy. Not giving people the whole scope here, that out of the 21 charges, he was found guilty on 19. And he faces, I think, as you said, a possible 136 years in military prison.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of World Can't Wait. And we're talking about the verdict in the Bradley Manning trial and everything that gets concentrated up in that. You know, this is the thing, and when you think about this, we will talk about more the concrete impact of all this, but there is an element that actually in some ways is concrete as well as philosophical and whatever in terms of the ethos. There is the morality issue tied up with all this. Who's the real criminal? And the fact that the crimes that Bradley Manning is charged with, what he's charged with is a much less serious crime than the crimes that he revealed, and the people who committed those crimes are walking around free and easy.
Yeah, and even the first day of the sentencing proceedings, which, by the way, are going to go on for weeks because there's now witnesses on both sides arguing over how much of a sentence Bradley is going to get, and we expect sometime around the end of August to have a sentence from the judge, which, of course, then all this must be appealed. But this is really interesting. By being in the courtroom, I even got much more of a sense of this, Michael. World Can't Wait had been distributing DVDs with the collateral murder video on it since early in May of 2010, even before anybody knew that Bradley Manning was connected to that release. Once WikiLeaks put it up. We knew it was really an essential thing for people to see this video, to see what the Apache helicopter was doing to the unarmed people, killing them, and then to hear, and this is even more important, I think, the soldiers laughing about it. You know, just brutal, with no heart at all, as they were trained to do standard operating procedure. And I thought, well, good, you know, let's get thousands of these out, and we've kept doing that. But I had no idea until I was in that courtroom hearing the government prosecutor, who's part of the military himself, of course, a major, lash out at Manning for distributing this video and how dangerous this video footage was, a piece of propaganda that the enemy could use. And, you know, you have to say to yourself, look, it's your own military footage. There was nothing added there. It was straight up absolute documentary footage of what the U.S. did. And that's the power of it. And they want to charge him with providing propaganda to the enemy when they did this themselves. And you can magnify that across all of the WikiLeaks documents, the Afghan war diaries and the Iraq war logs and even the Guantanamo detainee assessment brief, which he is charged with releasing. All of that evidence of the crimes the U.S. government carried out against whole peoples. Mm-hmm. And it's all put on Bradley Manning as if he caused any of this. Yeah, you know, the outrage and the levels of this are something that I hope people really grapple with. There's a lot of information out there on World Can't Wait and BradleyManning.org, including daily reports of the trial that are very revealing, as I'm mentioning, of what the government's approach is here.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Deborah Sweet from World Can't Wait, and we're talking about the verdict in the Bradley Manning case and the broader political implications of it all. Now, Deborah, one thing I wanted to ask you real quick in the sentencing phase, and I was thinking about this in relation to the question of the show trials, because often when people talk about show trials, there's this element of secret trials, you know, and the U.S. has always made, even though I understand the thing about it's a military trial and all this stuff, but there's this element of like the secret trials that they constantly are pointing to other regimes around the world, both in history as well as currently, they have secret trials. People are just packed away into a courtroom that nobody ever sees them again, and that's it. And here, even the sentencing phase of this trial, seems like I've read somewhere that it's actually going to be, one, be almost a retrial, but the very key parts of it are actually going to be kept secret, even from Manning himself.
Yeah, well, isn't this interesting? You know, here are the documents, especially Cablegate, which was the last release of WikiLeaks, which was classified cables, most of them classified, not secret, you know, the lowest level of classification, that were circulated by the U.S. about other governments. And some of it was laughable, and you could look at it and really understand the level of hatred that people in other countries must righteously feel towards this callous government just bullying other countries, even including the leading figures of other countries around. This was all released by Bradley, and on the one hand, they criticize him for not having read through everything, and on the other hand, him and his defense team are not really allowed to see it, and certainly the public isn't, and this is a lot of the way all these prosecutions since 9/11 under the rubric of national security interests have been carried out. Even the defendants aren't allowed to really know the details of what they're being charged with and what the evidence is, and that's how they're getting these convictions. And I think the idea of show trial holds here. If you can't be fully apprised of the evidence against you, can you really fight to get the truth out there? All of that said, I have been very impressed with David Coombs, who's the lead defense lawyer, and his really determined defense of Bradley, including very strongly bringing out this moral aspect of things whenever he could. One of the most moving things I've ever seen in a courtroom was his defense argument last Friday when he had no notes. He worked completely from having been inside this case for 3 years. He approached the judge and he walked her through three of the most horrifying parts of the collateral murder video and said, look at this as if you were a 22-year-old private seeing this and hearing your fellow soldiers laugh about literally seeing people picked off from a mile and a half and their bodies splattering across the street and people laughing about it.
Mm.
And this is what the defense attorney did. And I just give him so much credit for someone who's within the military system standing up and bucking a lot here and calling those of us that are in the courtroom his truth battalion, because the only shirts that we were allowed to wear, the only message we could bring in was just the word truth.
A poisonous word in that courtroom, no doubt.
Very dangerous,
right,
you know.
Right, exactly.
That almost got banned, but there was a fight about it, and we were able to wear those shirts.
You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Deborah Sweet, National Director of World Can't Wait, about the verdict in the Bradley Manning trial and everything that's concentrated up in that. Deborah, let me ask you.
This is not over.
This
is going to go on for years here, and we feel... I certainly feel, and I think I express the hope of a lot of people, that Bradley Manning should not do one more second in prison.
Absolutely. Now, let me ask you one last question, because I want to pull the lens back a little bit, and because everybody is sort of putting this together, because there is this connection. You've got this sort of cauldron of events here. You've got this perfect storm here, in a certain sense. You've got Bradley Manning, you've got Julian Assange, and you've got Ed Snowden. This stuff coming together, let's talk about the overall political impact of this and the importance of people responding to this in a suitable manner.
Well, you know, it's very interesting how nervous and I don't even know what the right term is, how upset the U.S. is with Russia for granting temporary asylum to Snowden. Manning, Snowden, and Assange, clearly the U.S. wants all of them locked up for a long time, if not worse. And here's Eric Holder, the Attorney General, having to write to Putin last week and say, look, it's okay for you to release him. We are not going to give him the death penalty, and he won't be tortured, because in this country, torture is illegal. In this country, torture is illegal. And on several levels, you have to look at that and say, torture is going right now on in the California prisons, as evidenced by the hunger strike and solitary confinement of 80,000 people every night in this country. You torture all over the world, since 9/11 in particular, with impunity, and this administration never went after those torturers, barely even investigated them. And here comes Edward Snowden and Julian Assange, who are both clearly very much endangered by this verdict and by a worldwide system of rendition and threats that could be brought to bear against both of them. And it is very, very heartening in the face of that, that they've stood firm, and that really millions and millions of people have come out to support them, and we need much more of a spirit of that. What the U.S. government has done in these wars and occupations and in the vast surveillance of whole populations is completely illegitimate.
And I understand, Deborah, just as on a closing note, I understand that Eric Holder actually had a secret correspondence with Putin where Putin insisted that he send a photo of his hands holding them up in the air, so that when he said, we promise we will not torture or kill Edward Snowden, that he was showing that his fingers weren't crossed. Okay? This is the insanity we've come to, all right? Deborah, thank you very much for joining us today. And people can find out more of what you're doing, including the ongoing campaign around Bradley Manning, which I think is extremely important. Go to worldcan'twait.net. Go there and you can actually hook into all of that.
And get a copy of this video. We'll send it to anybody who writes us.
That's right, actually. And I've been very impressed with the campaign. You want to get as many of them as out as you can, so that virtually everyone in this country has had a chance to see this terrible crime against humanity that Bradley Manning is being faced with, a life in jail for revealing to people, and as the only way that actually anything is going to be done around this. So, Deborah, thank you very much, and we'll have you back as this thing develops.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Deborah Sweet, the director of World Can't Wait, about the Bradley Manning verdict and the deeper political implications of it. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be talking with Osha Gray Davidson, a writer and a journalist in Rolling Stone. He just had his most recent article was The Great Burning, How Wildfires Are Threatening the West. This is going to be a really interesting segment, so stay tuned.
Midnight in the village, see the lights of candles from bitter end to gaslight. Bias leaves the stage. Olds takes notes when the black girl and guitar burn together on in rage. You've got what it takes. You say too much.
All right, that's David Bowie with You Will Set the World on Fire. All right, and I just was looking for a fire theme song, and that one just got into my head, and I couldn't get it out. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest, Osha Gray Davidson. Osha is a writer who focuses on energy and the environment and other social and human rights issues. He lives in Phoenix and is the author of the blog The Phoenix Sun on renewable energy. He's covered the environment for Rolling Stone for a long time, and his latest article in Rolling Stone is The Great Burning, How Wildfires Are Threatening the West, where he argues that terrifying blazes are the new normal in the West, a place where the lethal combination of climate change and Tea Party politics puts a whole region at risk. Osha, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Sure. I think your article was extremely important and people need to see this and read it and take it to heart. Let's get into the big problem that you posed in relation to these massive fires. Most recently, the example being the Yarnell fire, which just was so devastating. And being here in Southern California, we're used to a certain amount of fires. Sometimes it destroy whole mountainous areas, or, you know, even many years ago out in Malibu, there was this huge fire. But you're saying that this is no longer sort of to be considered an exception to the rule, but more normal in relation to fire season in this country. Can you explain what you're talking about here?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The average wildfire today burns twice as many acres as it did 40 years ago. And when you compare the annual average to the 1970s, a typical year in the last decade saw seven times as many large wildfires, the fires that are around 10,000 acres. And then the fires that are even larger, that burn 25,000 acres or more, occurred five times more frequently. So we're seeing more big fires. The forest or the wildland fire season in the West now is 78 days longer, 2.5 months longer than it was just two decades ago. So the situation with fire is getting more extreme throughout the West and throughout the United States.
Yeah, it's incredible. So 2.5 months longer, how long would that make it overall?
Oh, that's a good question. Unfortunately, I don't know. But I do know it varies, actually, from place to place, even throughout the West and certainly throughout the United States. But the situation is far more dire in the West because lower precipitation and faster evaporation with the growing heat. Now, Arizona, we have to look at temperatures as well as precipitation because Arizona is the fastest warming state in the nation. We've increased here, where I live in Arizona, 0.75 degrees Fahrenheit each decade since 1970, which means even if we get the same amount of rain, it'll evaporate sooner and faster. So there's less overall moisture there to hold fires down.
And I know this may be just conventional wisdom, but that also is a question of it creates a lot of dry tinder and stuff. But you've argued, and this is one of the things that really just blew my mind in reading your article. You argued that conventional wisdom might say that suppression of fires is the way to go in all this. But part of the problem is that fires have been suppressed, and that leads to a major, major outburst of these, what we have now.
Right. For about 100 years, the policy in the United States was called the 10 a.m. rule, which meant that fires were to be extinguished by the morning after they were spotted. And there were no exceptions to that rule. And the idea was, well, and it did make some sense on the face of it, that you want to, if you want to keep a small fire from becoming a huge fire, well, you put it out when it's a small fire. The problem is fire is a natural part of the environment. Especially in the West, these are fire-adapted ecosystems. Fire needs to come through periodically to clear out what's called the fuel load, so dead wood, brush, grasses. When you eliminate fire, when you suppress it all the time, you don't prevent wildfires, you delay wildfires, and you ensure that when you do have a wildfire, which is inevitable, it's going to be much, much larger because there's so much more fuel to burn.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Osha Gray Davidson, a writer for Rolling Stone and a writer on the environment and energy in general. And his article in the Rolling Stone, in the latest issue of Rolling Stone, pick this up and get it. You don't want to miss this article. It's called The Great Burning, How Wildfires Are Threatening the West. Now, Osha, one of the things I was just thinking about when you were talking about the impact of this whole thing, it is kind of stunning, some of the statistics that you bring out in your article, including the massive amount of acreage that has been burned, and the fact that, what is it, something like 400 million acres right now throughout the country are at risk of burning. And then you say this thing, which really I think is very interesting, that how much of it, a huge amount of the, what Arizona, what its mountains and everything are known for, its conifer trees, its pine trees, and you say that a vast amount of those trees have been actually wiped out. And what I'm wondering is, how does that question of suppression relate to allowing these trees to grow, or to preventing the burning down of these trees? How would actually allowing fires to actually, you know, proceed along their natural course, how would that impact these would it have a different impact in relation to these pine and conifer trees?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because like you said, it is kind of counterintuitive that fire is necessary to save, to keep a forest ecosystem healthy. But when you don't have fire come through periodically, when you suppress all fires, then you have all this dead wood and all these small trees growing up that ordinarily would be burned out. And when they're there, that increases the fuel load so that, again, once you finally do have a fire, that's going to burn so hot, so intense, that it will destroy those large trees that generally, in a natural environment, when fire is allowed to burn, will survive regular forest fires that burn periodically. But these very large and old trees can be burned if there's an understory of all this growth that's been allowed to survive that would have been taken out by smaller fires.
Tell me this. If the pine trees and the conifer trees burn in fires that are allowed to progress naturally, do these, or even now when they burn down in these massive fires, do these pine trees, do these same trees grow back, or does something else come up and take their place?
Yeah, that's a big problem. The experts I talk to say that in more and more areas that you're having an actual change in the ecosystem, because things don't grow back, in part because the climate, that what was there doesn't grow back, in part because the climate has changed, and in part because these ecosystems are not adapted to giant forest fires coming in. So we've upset the balance. These are not healthy forests anymore. And fires can actually change the whole ecosystem so that, no, there won't be necessarily in a lot of areas a recovery that includes the same species that used to dominate.
So that means actually the repercussions of that are immense. I mean, they could be immense. I mean, that, as you're saying, you're changing the entire ecosystem. That can play itself out down the chain and up the chain in ways we can't even conceive of now, right?
That's absolutely true. And that's what we're finding out. And unfortunately, we're having to find out by, instead of having a thought experiment and computer modeling, we're finding out by actually having these fires, giant fires, sometimes called megafires, sweep through and destroy areas. The changing nature of fires throughout the West and throughout the United States, one thing that I tried to bring out in the article that I think is really important is to change the narrative on wildfires, on how we look at wildfires. And I hope the Yarnell Hill tragedy helps do that, that instead of focusing on what the firefighters should or shouldn't have done, which is what's happening a lot here in Arizona and throughout the fire community, is, you know, what are the lessons learned? And there's a center called the Lessons Learned Center in Tucson that examines what happened after a forest fire or a wildland fire that kills firefighters. What could they have done differently? And that's great that they're doing that, but that's a micro view, and we need to have a macro view as a society to look at where we are with fire. And Thomas Harbour, who's the director of the Forest Service's Fire and Aviation Management Program, had a great analogy. He said that the situation today is like taking a football field, soaking the bleachers with gasoline, lighting it on fire, and then dropping a hotshot crew in the middle and expecting them to put it out. Well, in that kind of situation, we're still going, we have that kind of situation, and yet we then look at a tragedy afterwards and say, well, what should they have done differently, the hotshot crew? Well, no. What should we do differently so that we're not dropping hotshot crews in the middle of bleachers soaked with gasoline. How are they being soaked with gasoline? How can we stop doing that? And that's the larger discussion that needs to be held. And that's what I tried to bring out in the article, what those elements are that can be done at a much larger and more basic level.
Yeah, definitely. I was very impressed with that. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Osha Gray Davidson, a writer who focuses on energy, the environment, and other social and human rights issues. And he's covered the environment for Rolling Stone, and his latest article in the latest issue of Rolling Stone is The Great Burning, How Wildfires Are Threatening the West. Now tell me something. There's also another bigger part of the picture as well. You talk about the actual stuff, the mechanics in relation to how the fires are treated, how the fires are dealt with, and the suppression versus allowing the natural fire to go and all this other stuff. You talk about that. You talked about climate change and precipitation. But you also mentioned one of the taglines in your article as well is that the impact Tea Party politics has on the whole situation with the crisis in terms of the fire season, the damage, the destructive nature of the fires and all that. Let's talk about that a little. What are the Tea Party politics you're referring to?
Well, good, because that's where I think we need to focus. It's not just the Tea Party, but they symbolize and often are the driver behind this kind of view of the government as being all negative. We want the government to get off our backs. Let me back up one second and point out that one of the main drivers of the problem that we have with fires in the U.S. is that people have been moving in massive numbers into what's called the wilderness-urban interface. It's a fire-prone area throughout the United States, mostly in the West, where people want to move out of cities, a lot of people, and live in these beautiful areas, but they are fire-prone areas. The problem is they want to do it in an unregulated fashion when it comes to fire. We now have 1 in 3 housing units in the West in these fire-prone areas. In Arizona, it's 45% of new housing units are in the fire-prone area. It's not regulated. People can build houses out of materials that are fire-adapted, have metal roofs instead of wood roofs. There's all sorts of regulations that we could be doing to make fire-safe communities. In fact, there's a program called Fire Adapted Communities that's a very good one, and I would urge people to look that up online. But because of this anti-government, anti-regulation movement in the United States, symbolized and backed by the Tea Party, people don't want to listen to rules about how they should live in a fire-adapted way. So by resisting that, they put not only themselves at danger, but they put their neighbors at danger because it doesn't do any good. I talked to one woman in Yarnell where the fire was who I interviewed her outside of a Red Cross shelter. And she said, you know, she tried to keep her house, keep it fire-adapted, clear brush plants away from her house, have a fire-resistant roof. She said, but if my neighbors don't do that, then what good does it do? Because the fire will come and it'll burn my house if there's houses burning right nearby. So it has to be done as a community. And the only way to do that is through regulation. Because if you have people who say, well, I don't want to follow your rules, get off my back. Somebody pointed out to me is you have people who want the government off their back till the fire comes, and then they expect firefighters to save their asses. And that's just not a tenable situation. It puts their neighbors at risk, themselves at risk, and it also puts firefighters at risk, like the 19 hotshots who died in Yarnell trying to protect buildings.
You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Osha Gray Davidson, a writer for Rolling Stone, whose latest article in the latest issue of Rolling Stone is The Great Burning, How Wildfires Are Threatening the West. Let me say that we have time for one more question and you're going to have to answer it in about 2 minutes. So, you know, in relation to that, I wanted to talk a little bit about this. And I think it's, you know, in addition to the question of regulation, there's also this sort of driving need that this system has, you know, like the drive for profit and establishing these houses and building them up, throwing them up in whatever way they can and just, you know, not paying any attention to all this other safety. This is also a factor, I think, in terms of the, you know, even where things get developed. I mean, it's sort of, we see it here in California all the time. We're right on the edge of talk about the wilderness urban, you know, whatever it is. What did you call it? The wilderness-urban interface.
Interface.
Yeah.
It's also called the WUI.
Okay.
That's the acronym.
Well, WUI, I would feel a little bit. See, I'm starting to giggle even as I say that. And I shouldn't be giggling at it. But let me say this on a final note. And again, maybe 2 minutes. You end your article with a thing, or you come close towards the end, you talk about something that you were that really impressed you, and I thought it was an important point. You talk about communal responsibility as exhibited in the Granite Mountain Hotshots team, the firefighters that were killed in fighting the Yarnell fire. Let's talk about a little bit about that, the communal responsibility aspect of the thing. You talk about if people would stand up and recognize that we as humanity have a responsibility to live in sync with the environment and not against it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And what impressed me in part, you know, at so many levels, these hotshots who risk their lives and do such an amazing job, one of the things that impresses me and impressed me about them is, in particular, this one hotshot crew, the Granite Mountain hotshot crew, was known for being a very tight-knit crew and very close to the community. And that might be partly because they were the only one out of 110 hotshot crews across the country that was based, that was part of a city firefighting department, not linked to anything other than that. So they knew, they lived in this community, not Yarnell, Prescott mostly, but that's just 30 miles away. So they may have known people there, had friends there, relatives there, and they were trying to save that community. There's a sense of neighborliness, of responsibility for your community that is embodied in those hotshots, that if we all have that and practice that and are willing to consider the fate of our neighbors and our communities the same as ourselves, then the kind of problem that happened in Yarnell and the kind of problems that we have throughout the United States in fires and in many other ways would be greatly diminished, because there'd be a recognition of the commonweal, of the idea that we are all neighbors, and as you pointed out, not just with other people, but with the environment as well. And if we act that way, modeling our actions on the behavior of the hotshot crew, then this would be a much better place.
And exactly, and if only, I think, and the point is, what I'd say for my own self is that it would certainly open the door to doing what we need to do to actually be able to live in sync with the environment, which is get a whole new system. So I want to thank you very much, OSHA, for joining us today, and we will stay in touch, man, because I'm sure these fires are going to become a bigger and bigger issue, and I'll follow your work on your website. Tell people your website.
It's thephoenixsun.com.
Okay, and we'll talk to you again soon, OSHA. Take care now.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with OSHA Gray Davidson, who is the author of an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone called The Great Burning, How Wildfires Are Threatening the West. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Sansara Taylor, who's going to be reporting for us from the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, which is somewhere in the middle, the north middle of the country right now, I think, North Dakota, perhaps. And so stay tuned, and we'll find out all about that.
I opened a bank account when I was 9 years old. I closed it when I was 18. I gave them every penny that I'd saved, and they gave my blood and my urine a number. And now I'm sitting in this waiting room, playing with the toys. And I am here to exercise my freedom of choice. Past their handheld signs, I went through their picket lines. They gathered when they saw me coming. They shouted when they saw me cross. I said, why don't you go home? Just leave me alone. I'm just another woman lost. You are like fish in the water who don't know that they are wet. As far as I can tell, the world isn't perfect yet.
All right, welcome back. That was Ani DeFranco with Lost Woman's Song. And I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show, although my voice keeps going up and squeaking every now and then, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution and initiator of StopPatriarchy.org, and she's on the road with the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. We spoke with her last week. This is the leading edge of a counteroffensive to the war on women. We spoke with her last week, and she's going to be giving us an update and getting into all the critical questions that she's confronting and give us, let us know how this is going on. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be back with you.
Yeah. Well, all right. Where are you? Where have you been and where are you?
Where are you? I'm in Fargo, North Dakota. Me and a slew of abortion rights freedom riders. We're up here in Fargo. We're in North Dakota because yesterday was August 1st and there was four different laws that were scheduled to go into effect that would restrict abortion rights and abortion access in North Dakota. There's only one abortion clinic in the entire state, and for our crew that came from the West Coast, they drove the entire state. It takes about 7 hours. It's a huge state. There's one clinic in the state, and it was scheduled to be closed yesterday if these laws were not stayed by the courts, which they were, at least two of them. But I'd like to talk some about the specific laws and what they mean, but the fact that they were passed at all, and the fact that they are still on the books, this is just totally unacceptable and outrageous. It's part of the concentration point of the state of emergency facing women's rights and abortion rights in particular all across this country. So that's what brings us to Fargo.
Okay. You know, Fargo is a lot less scary to me than cornfields, okay, which is where you were last week, and I was very upset about that. Anyway.
We were on the road last week somewhere in Ohio.
Right, exactly. Well, let's get into the specific laws because this is, you know, you talk about, we've spoken about this before on the show, the massive offensive that's going up against the abortion rights in this country right now. And North Dakota has emerged as actually being on the sort of the spear point of a lot of this. Let's talk about the specific laws that you were mentioning.
Yeah, so there are five states in this country that only have one abortion clinic or abortion facility in the state, and North Dakota is one of them. And, you know, there's laws and attacks in each local area, but it's important to understand, and it's happening all across this country, but it's important to understand these are local flashpoints in a national battle, and that the anti-abortion movement has very much calculated which states they think get the furthest, and they've really targeted these states with only one clinic. So here in North Dakota, they passed four different laws this past year. One of them would have banned abortion after fetal heartbeat can be detected with a vaginal ultrasound. So that would have banned abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, which is well before most women even find out that they're pregnant, much long before a lot of women can get access, even if they do know they're pregnant, to an abortion facility. That law was an injunction was granted against that, a temporary injunction, last week. This week there was a hearing on Wednesday, actually, about the law that was the one that was in danger of closing the only clinic, which is a law that would have required hospital admitting privileges to doctors who provide abortions. In North Dakota, all the doctors fly in from out of state. This is very common in places with one clinic. A lot of the places, it's very dangerous for abortion providers to live anywhere, but especially in places like this. And so they fly in from out of state. There's very few doctors who are willing to take all of that on that burden on them. So they fly in from out of state, and they would not be granted admitting privileges to hospitals. First of all, it's medically unnecessary. It's a bogus, made-up law just designed to close down this clinic. It's the same law that was passed in Texas that would close down many clinics there. But here in North Dakota, there's three hospitals nearby. One is Catholic and would not allow abortions or admitting privileges. One is for veterans, and federal laws prohibit any association with abortion. And the third one is a hospital that its rules of operation require that if before it grants admitting privileges to you as a doctor, you have to have admitted five patients in the last 12 months. Abortion is too safe. Abortion is just too safe. Doctors, it's such a routine, safe procedure. In the 15 years that the Red River Women's Clinic here in Fargo has been open, they've only ever had one patient who's had to go to the hospital for a complication.
Wow.
So there's just no way that any doctor would get that privilege. And So it would have shut down the clinic. Now, there was a stay on that order, as there was an injunction temporarily granted. So the clinic stayed open. They saw patients yesterday. We were there. It was very important. But I think, if you forgive me to go on just a little bit further
sure,
about the legalities of this, because I think there's a lot that needs to be understood about this, is that in the broader, most people don't even know this in North Dakota. Most people have no idea. But among those who are paying attention and the coverage that's been, there's been some national coverage and some national following, there is a sense right now among abortion rights supporters that this was a great victory. And of course, it is a victory that the clinic is still open. It matters tremendously to the patients yesterday and to the women in the state going forward. But yesterday another law went into effect that is moving the bar even further along restricting women's access to abortion. It went into effect yesterday, which is a 20-week ban, which makes it illegal for women to get an abortion after 20 weeks. Allegedly, this is because of fetal pain. It's totally scientifically disputed. There's no basis to assert that fetuses feel pain at 20 weeks. And besides the fact that that's actually not the criteria, it's irrelevant. Fetuses are not human beings. They're part of a woman's body. They're a subordinate part of a woman's body. And just because something causes pain does not make it illegal. Childbirth is one of the most painful things there is. I don't hear these people outlawing childbirth. Because it causes pain to the woman. Not that we would want to outlaw that, but it's an absurd standard. So that went into effect, which will restrict abortion rights for women in North Dakota, and it's on the books, and it will have implications nationally. It's setting precedent. And the other thing is that even when the judge stayed the law around hospital admitting privileges, the state argued that they want to do discovery. They want to dig into the whole record of all the doctors who practice abortion in North Dakota, not just their records at the clinic here, but their records at their clinics in Minneapolis and South Dakota. These doctors who fly and travel to different places, they want to dig into their whole medical history because the state claims that this is of relevance to the safety of women in North Dakota, which is a lie. But it's a fishing expedition, and it's a witch hunt against these doctors. They want to dig in and do discovery on the one patient who was sent to the emergency room and open up her case and dig in and make that public knowledge what happened to her. All of this is part of tarnishing the images and the ability to practice and the safety of these doctors and of the clinic. And it's within this ruling, which was a favorable ruling that kept the clinic open, there is an allowing of for the state to continue to persecute these doctors and the heroes who put their lives on the line every day to provide women with this service. And we've seen this play out around the country. It's breaks on an assault, but it is not stopping or reversing this whole trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners.
Why we're doing the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution and one of the initiators of StopPatriarchy.org. And she's currently on the road with the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, the leading edge of a counteroffensive to the war on women that's occurring all over this country. Sansara, along the lines of what you've just been talking about, you know, I read some things on your Tumblr, on your blog, on the site, on the StopPatriarchy.org site. You know, it's very impressive what I've seen about the chord that you're striking among a lot of people. And I'd like you to tell people a little bit about the response you're getting as you take this out, because a lot of people will look at this and say, are you out of your mind? Abortion is so controversial. What the hell are you doing here? You guys are really taking your life in your hands going out with this. What's the response you've been getting? What have you been tapping into?
Well, I think, you know, everywhere we've been, we've connected with a number of things. One is that there's a tremendous reservoir of people who are outraged by the assaults on women's right to abortion. And we've been telling the truth. We say forced motherhood is female enslavement, and that's what this anti-woman, anti-abortion program is about. It's never been about babies. And we're bringing this message out. Women should have abortion on demand and without apology. And there's sort of three big things we've encountered. One is that there are people who are so heartened by that, and they've felt silenced. They've been put on the defensive. They've been told they can't use the word abortion. They've been told that they have to compromise. And we've been gathering up those voices. We've been documenting them, blogging them, sharing them, and trying to amplify them, because it really matters that those of us who understand this is not the time to mince words or hold our tongues. Women's lives, you said, we take our lives into our hands, and we have on this freedom ride, but women's lives across the country and actually around the world are at stake, and it's time for people to speak uncompromisingly. But I think the other thing that's even deeper, and then we've had people who oppose us, and sometime it would be interesting to talk about that, but what I really want to speak about is those who say, I agree with you, but you can't say that. Abortion on demand without apology. You'll alienate people. I agree with you that these rights are really at stake, but you know, we have to tone it down. We have to seek common ground. You know, people who've found it challenging what we're saying and that, you know, who are on our side. And I think that there's a moment here where we've been struggling with people. One thing we've been asking them, and I've told people repeatedly, it's time for us to stop compromising. The anti-abortion movement has never, they've changed tactics, they've changed how they're going at things, but they've never said, oh, you know what, you're right, maybe we should have more birth control. Okay, you're right, maybe we should, you know, provide for better sex education. They've pushed abstinence only, they've pushed anti-birth control, they've never conciliated on their core message that women's duty is to bring the term every pregnancy, and that frankly, sex should always be about procreation in the context of a marriage. And you seek common ground with that, you never ever appease these people. You just disorient and demobilize people who ought to be supporting this right. So that there's so much stigma on abortion, so much defensiveness among abortion rights supporters. And this is one of the things that we are having a fierce struggle with people over. We have to tell the truth uncompromisingly, and we have to get out ourselves and rely on ourselves and struggle. The courts may slow some of these attacks, but they are conciliating with these attacks. The courts are shifting on this. The politicians, there might be some politicians who challenged some things. Wendy Davis did something which was frankly pretty heroic, but that law was passed. That law was passed in Texas, you know, that would close down 37 out of 42 clinics. These rights are being taken away, and there's not a politician or a court order that's going to stop this. We have to tell the truth. We have to get out there and struggle through mass protest, mass political resistance, mass truth-telling, and uncompromisingly. And it's on us, and we have to not just protest in hopes that it pressures politics, but protest because we want all of society to stand up and say women are human beings, and we are going to fight and defeat this war on women and the whole culture behind it and all the state power behind it. There has to be resistance to this. And that is going to take, that's why we call ourselves a freedom ride, because women's enslavement is what's at stake, and because it takes us relying on ourselves, and people have to step out, and they should join with us through this Saturday. We're having a protest downtown Fargo. We'll be in Wichita, Kansas, on August 10th. We're having a protest there. People should caravan and join us. That's where Dr. George Tiller was assassinated. We'll be down in Jackson, Mississippi, where there's one clinic left in the state. On August 17th, we're having a major rally there, and people should caravan into Jackson to join us there. I believe we're going to add on stops on our way back to New York and back to San Francisco. On our return trips, we'll probably be stopping in North Carolina because there are laws there that would close 4 out of the 5 clinics that do abortions in North Carolina. And people need to join with this physically, join us in those places, or virtually, be a virtual freedom rider. Connect with us through stoppatriarchy.org. Go to stoppatriarchy.tumblr.com and connect with the Movement for Revolution to actually dig into where all this is coming from and build up the strength to put an end to all of it, and follow what we're doing on this ride, too, through revcom.us. That's the website of Revolution Newspaper. It's revcom.us. So I really want to give a call to everybody listening. If anything I've said has struck a chord with you, or even if it seems extreme to you, come to these websites, get further engaged, because really the future of women, I just tell one story. We met this woman in North Dakota who volunteers at the clinic here, and she's 70 years old, and she told us, you know, people talk about when abortion is illegal, it still goes on, and women die, and we've heard many stories like that of friends who died when it was illegal. Since we've been on the road, people have shared with us, but this woman told a story which I think captures more of the full scope.
You've only got 30 seconds, Sansar.
All women. Okay. She said when she was 17 years old in 1960, she got pregnant. And she looked at her possibilities. In 1960, it wasn't just that she could risk her life to terminate it. She didn't know about abortion. She was either going to have the child and give it up for adoption or get married in a relationship she never should have had. And that's what happened to her. It's what happened to millions of people. And she shared this with us, so that's why she volunteers at this clinic. The future for all women is at stake right now. So everybody here has a stake in this freedom ride. You should get connected and be part of strengthening and spreading this movement.
All right, Sansara Taylor, thank you very much, and we'll have you back again next week. And I'm looking forward to, we're going to have you on for an hour towards the end of the freedom ride to talk about some of the bigger questions and everything you've been going through. So let's keep this going and keep it up. And I'll be riding with you virtually, okay? There you go.
Great. Thank you,
Michael. All right. Take care now. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution and initiator of StopPatriarchy.org, and she's on the road with the Abortion Rights Freedom March, and we're going to be following her each and every week until it comes to an end. And that also brings to an end another show. I want to thank my engineer for today, Federico Garcia, my intern and production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my assistant producer, Henry Carson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to follow me, you can on Facebook and Twitter. If you want to write to me, you're also free to do that. And I do try to answer whatever emails I get, or at least I read them all. All right? That's a pretty good promise there. And you can do that at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And just before we wrap up the show entirely, there's a little something I want to read from Bob Avakian. And it has to do with the last segment of the show, what we've been talking about there, the fact that women are human and need to be treated as such, and we need to fight around that, all right? And this is from Bob Avakian. You cannot break all the chains except one. You cannot say you want to be free of exploitation and oppression, except you want to keep the oppression of women by men. You can't say you want to liberate humanity, yet keep one half of the people enslaved to the other half. The oppression of women is completely bound up with the division of society into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited, and the ending of all such conditions is impossible without the complete liberation of women. All this is why women have a tremendous role to play, not only in making revolution, but in making sure there is all the way revolution. The fury of women can and must be fully unleashed as a mighty force for proletarian revolution. Again, that's from Bob Avakian, and you can check out all this on the site revcom.us. We're going to go out now with a song that I think is very fitting for today's show. It's We Got to Make a Change, and it's from Mickey and the Soul Generation.